and better. He reveals his desire to be left alone and his conflicting need for recognition. I am waiting for a good movie about me. Finally, he makes the ultimate claim of this type of offender. I am now in control of all things. For a man with no murders left to claim, no real reason for continuing the dialogue, it reads like a suicide note. It may well have been. Epilogue. After all these years, it is safe to say that the Zodiac is not likely to resurface and continue his reign of terror in the San Francisco Bay Area. But I am still asked if there was anything we could have done differently to get him. By 1980, I'd been at Quantico a few years and had some research under my belt when I learned the FBI wanted to take another look at the body of Zodiac literature. I remember getting a file of letters to look at, and I had several conversations with Murray Miron about the finer points of our analytical approaches. Before we could get too deeply involved, however, the letters were pulled. I never did find out what prompted the renewed interest at the Bureau, or what caused our involvement to be canceled. And as usual, I was up to my ass in alligators already, so I didn't spend much time considering the matter. I do believe that if we saw a case like this today, we'd have some success employing proactive techniques like those mentioned throughout this chapter. With this type of offender, a profile is much less important than the proactive techniques, and these should be designed to play off the subject's interests and weaknesses. In the case of the Zodiac, some hot buttons might be his need to taunt and express superiority over police, his need to seek credit for his crimes, and his overwhelming need to establish credibility. I would suggest that this last point would be one of his greatest weaknesses, because it is unusual for this type of subject to seek credit for his crimes. Guys like this are paranoid. They don't want all that attention. It strengthens the case for Sherry Joe Bates's murder to be a focal point for the investigation. He didn't want the recognition, then he did. There's something there. What he would have had in common with other killers is that he's always out looking for victims, as evidenced by all the reports of the suspect vehicle driving around the Lake Herman Road crime scene, and the witnesses who reported the strange man lurking around Lake Berryessa all afternoon on the day Cecilia Shepherd and Brian Hartnell were attacked. Like other subjects, the Zodiac could be influenced by his own press. Remember how quickly he responded to the challenge to provide details on the Farron Majeau attacks? I think the Zodiac could be lured out to grave sites or memorial services on the anniversaries of the murders. With the Zodiac, the signature element to his crimes is his taunting of the police. The murders themselves are merely symbolic of his superiority, designed to quash his overwhelming feelings of inferiority and inadequacy. Any technique that gave him the perception he was matching wits with the police would be a potentially good idea. So, for example, you could go back to the location of the first known case, Bates, Riverside, and announce a community meeting where the police would give a status update on the case presented by the lead investigator. To puff him up, you'd announce that the mayor and or other community bigwigs would attend. The meeting should be held in a public arena such as a local school, but the site should be one people have to drive to. You want to videotape the audience, looking for the guy with the big smile on his face. You note license plate numbers for every car in the parking lot, knowing his is probably there. And you announce that you're looking for community involvement. Anyone interested in volunteering to assist us, please sign up and register before you leave tonight. You could even skew the list of respondents to target your subject without making it too obvious. Say, volunteers must be over 18, must have their own car, and must be familiar with the area. Knowledge of simple police procedure is helpful, but not necessary. If 500 people sign up, at least you have a working list. You eliminate all the women and go from there. There was one idea that I think was good, although it wasn't designed to get enough or the right kind of information. When the movie Zodiac ran at the Golden Gate Theater in San Francisco, audience members were invited to fill in a slip with their guess as to why the Zodiac killer committed his crimes. A motorcycle was offered for the best entry. This would appeal to the killer's desire to be strong and macho, and it offered opportunity for him to show how much he knows, or at least to get in another veiled jab at the police, and as we know from his later letters, the Zodiac followed popular movies and yearned to see one about himself. So who was the Zodiac? Or a better and more meaningful question might be, what kind of personality is or was he? A man once described by San Francisco homicide detective Dave Toski as a very, very good suspect, and who has been the subject of intense investigation by Robert Graysmith in his research, certainly fits the description I would put together. Highly intelligent, IQ estimated around 135, spent much of his adult life living with his mother, with whom he had a difficult relationship at best, educated in chemistry and trained in codes, a hunter who once described man as the most dangerous game to a friend. And he could be placed in the different jurisdictions at the time each of the Zodiac crimes occurred. He had been a student at Riverside College, lived near other crime scenes, and received a speeding ticket near Lake Berryessa the very evening of the attacks there. He was also once observed by his sister-in-law to be holding a piece of paper upon which were written strange symbols. The day of the attack at Lake Berryessa, he was observed to have a bloody knife in his car, which he explained as having been used to kill chickens. And during one of the gaps in communication from the Zodiac, this man had been in prison serving time on a child molestation charge, although he told others he'd been arrested because he was the Zodiac. Despite these and many more circumstantially incriminating facts, the police had no direct evidence on which to arrest and formally charge him in connection with any of the Zodiac crimes. This suspect died of a heart attack in 1992 at age 58. There are others, but my thought is that any good suspect in this case shares the qualities listed above, which is why I have not provided that man's name. None of them is likely to be brought to trial now. The important consideration here is to move forward in our understanding so that we can be as proactive with this type of offender as he is with us. Chapter 5. American Dreams, American Nightmares. There will always be cases that haunt us, the victim's story so compelling, the nature of the crime so heinous, that they will never be forgotten. But we hope that as advances are made in the forensic and behavioral sciences, fewer and fewer cases will have the power to haunt strictly because they have gone unsolved or had questionable outcomes. In the previous chapter, we saw how the traditional tried-and-true investigative approaches that worked in the old days were not enough to solve a series of murders committed by a modern serial criminal. The Zodiac thwarted investigators in large measure because his motive was not recognizable among the classical motives of greed, jealousy, anger, revenge, and the like. Something clear, or at least identifiable, that determined victim selection, M.O., and ultimately, the course of the investigation. Now we'll explore three cases that are particularly illustrative of how an offender's motive, or apparent lack thereof, can be instrumental in understanding a crime and directing an investigation. And to further make the point, we'll begin with a case from well before the days of criminal profiling or behavioral analysis, the murder of the Black Dahlia. The Black Dahlia. Elizabeth Short had big dreams, and her story is one of a young woman's quest to break out of the mold expected universally of her sex at the time, swapping the promise of husband and family for career and fame and the glamour of Hollywood. Ironically, her brutal death won her the fame she longed for, as her tragic and pathetic existence was transformed by the press into the romantic image of a beautiful starlet to be. And as Stuart Swayze wrote in his publisher's preface to John Gilmore's study of the case, Severed, the Black Dahlia murder, unlike such earlier headline-grabbing cases as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and the Lindbergh kidnapping, was the first case to command the attention of post-war America with its stark carnality. Around 10 a.m. on January 15, 1947, Betty Bursinger was out for a walk with her three-year-old daughter when she saw what she thought was a broken department store mannequin lying in an overgrown vacant lot at 39th Street near Norton Avenue in the Limert Park section of Los Angeles, south of Hollywood. When she got closer, she realized it was the nude and dismembered body of a woman, Although several witnesses had seen various cars in the vicinity, passers-by had seen no body as late as 8:30. Officers Frank Perkins and Will Fitzgerald responded to the police call. From what they could tell, the dead woman had been sexually posed, lying on her back with her arms raised over her shoulders, elbows bent, legs spread wide apart. The lower torso was angled upward at the hips, leading police to believe she had been in a semi-recumbent position at the time of death. After death, she had been cut in half at the waist, and the severed sections had been placed in line about 10 inches apart. The liver was exposed. Her face and breasts had been badly slashed, including deep slashes from both sides of her mouth, as though her killer were fashioning a grotesque extension of her smile. Ligature marks were visible on her ankles, wrists, and neck, and police surmised that she had been suspended by her ankles and tortured. A vertical incision that looked like a hysterectomy scar was between her pubic area and navel. Her pubic hair had been shaved or plucked. The scene was soon thick with reporters, photographers, and onlookers. The body was taken to the L.A. County morgue for fingerprinting. With the help of the Los Angeles Examiner's facilities, the prints were sent to the FBI. They were identified as belonging to Elizabeth Short, 22 years of age, who had been printed when she'd held a government job at a military post exchange. She had also been arrested as a juvenile delinquent while out with men at a bar one night near Camp Cook in Santa Barbara. Autopsy findings suggested that the victim's body had initially been placed face down in dew-wet grass, then turned over, and that she had been dead at least 10 hours prior to disposal. There was some evidence, though, that she might have been refrigerated to aid preservation during that time. The cause of death was listed as hemorrhage and shock due to concussion of the brain and lacerations of the face. But because of evidence of bleeding out through a severed artery in the abdomen, she might actually have been cut in half before death. No evidence of semen was in or on her body, but examination of her stomach revealed that she had been forced to swallow feces as part of her torture. The body and hair had been carefully washed after death. As for victimology, Elizabeth Short had been born in Hyde Park, Massachusetts, on July 29, 1924, the third of five daughters of Cleo and Phoebe Short, moving at an early age to Medford, near Boston. Cleo abandoned the family when Elizabeth was young, faking suicide and leaving Phoebe on her own. When Cleo contacted Phoebe years later from California to seek reconciliation, she refused. Young Elizabeth was often ill with asthma and tuberculosis and had to undergo serious lung surgery, so Phoebe sent her to Miami, Florida in 1940 when she was 16. This allowed her to drop out of school and wait on tables. She stayed in Florida until she moved to California. She was called Betty by her family and friends, but changed that to Beth as a young adult. At 5'5" and 115 pounds, with blue eyes and dark hair, she was described as a sweet, romantic, vulnerable girl who wanted to marry a handsome serviceman, preferably a pilot. Some people thought she resembled the actress Deanna Durbin, who was a role model for teenaged girls and often appeared dressed in black. Beth began to dress that way to create an image for herself. In early 1943, while working at Camp Cook, she had become involved with a jealous Marine, of whom she continued to be afraid. She repeated this story often, and it became part of her personal myth. That summer, she found her father living in Vallejo, working at the Mare Island Naval Base. He allowed her to move in, but the relationship was strained. Cleo disapproved of what he considered Beth's obsession with men and her lazy and untidy ways. After her arrest at the bar near Camp Cook, she was sent home to Medford. Her goal remained, however, to end up in Hollywood and become an actress. She visited relatives in Miami Beach and on New Year's Eve, 1945, fell in love with a pilot named Matt Gordon, who was then sent overseas. One story has it that they became engaged, another that Gordon was already married and their engagement was only Beth's fantasy. At any rate, she confided to a friend that she was still a virgin when, back in Medford, she received a telegram from Gordon's mother saying he had been killed. The newspaper article announcing his death was in her belongings when she died less than 2 years later. She went to Long Beach, California to visit an old boyfriend, Gordon Fickling, also a serviceman. He put her up in a hotel miles from his base, but the relationship didn't seem to be going anywhere. Just about that time, the Raymond Chandler movie, The Black Dahlia, came out, starring Veronica Lake and Alan Ladd. Some of her servicemen friends started calling Beth the Black Dahlia because of her shiny black hair and propensity for dressing in black, down to her sheer black underwear and black ring on her finger, her red lipstick and nail polish, and her constant talk about becoming an actress and movie star lent her a glamorous persona. Beth liked the Hollywood nightlife and tried to be seen at the right places to be recognized and discovered. Most of her hangouts were near the mythic intersection of Hollywood and Vine. But despite her glamorous dream, her life seemed aimless and somewhat tawdry, living on the edge, doing or saying whatever she needed to get people to take her in or do what she wanted. When she couldn't pay her share of the rent on an apartment she occupied with seven other young women, she went down to San Diego, where she was taken in by sympathetic Dorothy French, who found her sleeping in the movie theater where she worked. Beth lived with the Frenches without working or contributing to her upkeep until she was offered a ride back to Los Angeles by a pipe clamp salesman named Robert Manley, nicknamed Red. They stayed together the night of January 8, 1947. Then he dropped her off the next day at the Biltmore Hotel, where she said she was meeting her sister. Red Manley became the chief suspect in her murder. LAPD put him through a grueling interrogation, twice administering polygraphs. 2 days later, he was released, but he collapsed in exhaustion and, sometime later, was given shock treatments for depression. When he was a psychiatric patient at Patton State Hospital in 1954, he rambled on about having committed a murder, but an administration of sodium pentothal revealed he knew nothing of the crime. He died in 1986, exactly 39 years to the day from the date he had dropped off Beth at the Biltmore. Police found luggage that Short had checked at the bus terminal. Inside were photos, clothing, and stacks of letters to and from men for whom she felt romantic attachment. The authorities were inundated with calls from people who had known her, but her own father refused to get involved, saying he had not seen her since 1943. Her mother, who first learned of her daughter's death from a reporter who had managed to track her down faster than the police, made the trip to Los Angeles to claim her body. Then, after the inquest, Beth was buried in Oakland's Mountain View Cemetery. Police had hoped strange people might attend the memorial service and give them some leads, but none showed. Not long afterward, a package was sent to the Los Angeles Herald-Examiner. An accompanying note, created from newspaper letters, stated, "Here is Dahlia's belongings," and "Letter to follow." Enclosed were Short's social security card, birth certificate, a telegram, photographs with various servicemen, business cards, the newspaper clipping about Matt Gordon's death, and claim checks for the suitcases left at the bus station. There was also an address book with several pages torn out. A note to police near the end of January indicated the killer was going to turn himself in, but then another note arrived saying he had changed his mind and that the killing had been justified. On January 26th, a purse and black suede shoes were found at a garbage dump on East 25th Street. Manley identified them as Short's. This suggested the killer was traveling north and may have been returning to the murder site. But nothing came of the discovery. Some of the police and press theories about the Black Dahlia's killer mirrored the Jack the Ripper speculation. One faction believed that this was a first killing for the offender, and that the dismemberment indicated medical knowledge and training. Others thought they were dealing with a serial offender. In this vein, one suggested suspect was the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run, who had killed, mutilated, and dismembered a dozen people in Cleveland between 1935 and 1938. He was believed to be a woman-hating homosexual sadist. The killings there had stopped after 3 years, with no solution. LAPD homicide Captain John Donahoe and some of his detectives theorized from the viciousness of the injuries and that Short used to hang out with women that the killer was female, reminiscent of the Jill the Ripper theory. Short bore scratches on her arm said to be inflicted by a jealous woman friend. Various suspects were investigated, picked up, and questioned, but none of them panned out. Others, both men and women, confessed to the crime. Many, if not most of them, displayed psychiatric problems. The press quickly seized on the image of the beautiful young starlet so tragically and viciously murdered, and their coverage captured the public imagination. Like many other high-profile cases before and after it, Short's killing sparked several copycat sex crimes in the area. 3 days after Short's body was found, Mary Tate was savagely attacked and then strangled with a silk stocking. A month later, Jean French was found mutilated, with obscenities written on her corpse in lipstick. Another woman was mutilated. Then throughout the summer, 3 more suffered gruesome deaths through beating and/or strangulation. All bore some features that seemed to link them to Short's death. Killed in one place, then transported to another. Several were barflies. Some bodies were nude. And detectives worked hard to figure out if there were any direct connections. As they investigated Short's death, police discovered a sharp contrast between the image and the reality. The Black Dahlia lived mostly at or below poverty level in California, essentially homeless. Police uncovered many rumors about Beth Short, one of the most prominent being that she had an underdeveloped vagina. There were stories that though she didn't have vaginal sex with her boyfriends, she performed oral sex in exchange for whatever she needed, shoes, clothing, a room for the night. Who she really was and what she really did or did not do is largely lost in myth. The Black Dahlia case haunted the public because of its aura of seedy glamour and the easy irony of how quickly the American dream can turn into the American nightmare. But what I see here is so much more pathetic than that. Elizabeth Short longed for something that always eluded her. She had 2 goals, to become a movie star and to marry a serviceman. Fame and fortune on the one hand and domestic stability and normalcy on the other. At that time, the movie stars had the image of being at the top, but the reality was that the servicemen were the true heroes. They had just saved the world. Either of those lives could have made her happy, but because of her background and personality, she was able to achieve neither. Like Hollywood itself, the image was hollow. In her early 20s, her beauty was already fading, and her teeth were rotting because she had no access to dental care. She was never a movie star, never even a starlet. She was just a poor, sad girl who wanted something for herself. Beth Short was young and emotionally vulnerable and needy, with a highly dependent personality. Because of the lifestyle she led, I hesitate to say chose, but I suppose we have to acknowledge this, she was a high-risk victim. Like Tennessee Williams's Blanche DuBois, she relied on the kindness of strangers. She could easily be targeted by anyone who wanted to dominate or hurt women, and her killer would be the type who's always on the hunt. He could have spotted her a mile away. The homicide falls under the heading of lust murder, as is clearly indicated by the torture to which the victim was subjective antemortem. But I would be hesitant to categorize this unsub as being in the same sort of crazed frenzy as we saw in Jack the Ripper's mutilations. The combination of the sawing in half, as opposed to frantic disembowelment, and the washing of the body indicates to me someone who knows he's got to get rid of his evidence. The washing is to eliminate forensic clues, and the severing of the body is for easier and less apparent transport. These are the actions of an organized offender, which combined with the more disorganized elements of the case, for a mixed presentation. Since the body was found in a vacant lot, we know it had to be physically carried at least some distance. We know people were in the area with some frequency before the body was found, and that it was found shortly after it was dumped. From this we can conclude that the killer might have been seen by a witness, but did not arouse much suspicion. That speaks to the possibility that he carried the body in a bag or even 2 bags. Transportation would have been a lot easier in 2 pieces. Of course, if it could be shown forensically that the sawing of the body had taken place before death, I would have to reevaluate its meaning. I would still say that this was a lust murder, but then the offender becomes more of the disorganized type, more obviously mentally aberrational. We can still conclude that the offender had an automobile because, frankly, there isn't any other way of getting the body to the dump site, and this is not the kind of thing you'd risk borrowing a friend's car for. Generally, the lust murderers we see don't drive vehicles. More times than not, they're disorganized types of personalities, often bordering on the psychotic. And in 1947, when fewer people had cars, it would be even more unusual for a disorganized personality to have one. This can tell us something about the killer. He's functional. He's not disorganized 24 hours a day. It may be that he's a chronic alcoholic, for example, who is able to hide or handle his problem well enough that he can still hold down a job. He has to have money to maintain his vehicle, keep it gassed up, etc. He probably worked with his hands, possibly in a job involving blood, such as at a slaughterhouse, or he could be a seasoned hunter. To do what he did to the victim, both antemortem and postmortem, he also had to have a house or apartment of his own. It could be small and run down as long as it was someplace private, with access to running water, where he knew he would not be interrupted. So now we know the unsub can't have been poor, at least not compared to his victim. He had to have money for rent as well as car expenses. Even if he stole the car, he'd still need a private place to go. The fact that the body was placed where people would quickly see it rather than where it would not be found for days or weeks tells us the killer wanted to shock and offend the community by what he'd done. And he communicated with the police, which was unusual for this type, again giving us a mixed presentation. This unsub wanted credibility, much like the Zodiac, although he was not nearly as organized, bright, nor detached. In the Ripper examination, we discussed general motives of the lust murderer. Here I would add that the sadistic elements, the degradation and humiliation inflicted upon this victim, forcing feces down her throat, for example, and the selection of the dump site for the body all indicate this killer's need to make a statement with his crime. It's not just this particular woman. His rage is directed at all women. And in selecting his dump site, he further shows his anger against humanity. All of these points are important because as indicators of motive, they tell us this was not the type of crime we'd expect a jealous boyfriend to commit in the heat of passion. Nor is it, to shoot down another theory suggested by some, the actions of a frustrated suitor who, in a drunken frenzy, went nuts when he learned that this girl was the ultimate tease. She didn't even have the proper equipment to have sex with him. These scenarios, and or one involving a female offender, do not match the particular motive of this unsub as evidenced by the crime. We would not see this level of degradation and mutilation from any of these other types. These are the actions of someone who fantasizes continually about hurting someone, who is on the hunt regularly for someone to dominate and to punish, and who knows just what he wants to do to that person once he gets her under his control. While the washing and sawing appear to have been elements of modus operandi, performed to help him successfully commit and get away with a crime, the torture and carving of the smile into the victim's face were signature elements, those emotionally necessary and satisfying to the offender. Doing all this took some time. We've already discussed the disorganized elements of this unsub's personality, yet he was able to fantasize, plan, and carry out this time-consuming, complicated crime. For this reason, we'd expect him to have some criminal history before his encounter with Beth Short. As we've shown repeatedly, you don't jump into this kind of thing without some criminal evolution and development. I would also have advised police to try and link any of the so-called copycat murders that happened afterward. Someone this advanced in his murderous fantasies would not have been satisfied with one. Unless he was stopped, he'd continue. I'd even go so far as to say that if we saw this case today in isolation, we'd still know immediately that we were dealing with a serial killer. As reported by John Gilmore in his book Severed, some indicators link the Black Dahlia murder to an unsolved case from the year before, that of Georgette Bauerdorf, an oil heiress and beautiful L.A. socialite, whose father, back in New York, worked with newspaper tycoon William Randolph Hearst. After Short's murder, Aggie Underwood, an aggressive crime reporter for Hearst's Herald Express, wanted LAPD to reinvestigate the Bauerdorf case. Bauerdorf, who had known Beth Short through one of her hangouts, had been strangled before she was dumped face down in her bathtub, a piece of towel wedged in her throat. Sheriff's investigators were unable to locate a 6'4", dark-complected soldier with a limp who had dated Georgette. She had been frightened of him and had broken off their relationship. A man of similar description was witnessed near her murder scene. I'd say we have to seriously consider the possibility that Short's killer also killed Georgette Bauerdorf. Both are lust murders, both involve bathtubs, and they were relatively close in time. Gilmore has done extensive research into the Short case. In the early 1980s, he produced a tape recording of an interview he had done with a man named Arnold Smith. Smith was tall and thin, with a limp and a long rap sheet. He claimed to Gilmore that a character named Al Morrison killed Beth Short, and that Morrison had related the details to him. Gilmore went over his material with John St. John, the detective who had taken over the case in the 1960s. I actually met St. John once when he had already achieved near legendary status. He held LAPD detective badge number one. He died in 1995 at age 77, having retired only 2 years previously. According to Gilmore, St. John believed that Smith and Morrison were one and the same. At one point, Smith brought Gilmore a box of Short's belongings, including a handkerchief and a photo of her with a blonde woman, Smith, and another man he identified as Morrison. Smith gave a detailed account of Short's killer taking her to a Hollywood hotel, where it became evident that she hadn't realized he was planning to share the room with her. She reportedly refused liquor and was uninterested in a relationship with Morrison. He took her to another house and assaulted her when she wanted to leave. According to Smith's account to Gilmore, the killer threatened to rape Short. She screamed, and he hit her again and again until she stopped moving. Smith provided a full description of how the killer had tied her and stuffed her panties into her mouth before cutting, draining, and washing her body, including fairly convincing details such as how he laid boards across the bathtub to cut her in half and wrapped her in an oilskin tablecloth and shower curtain and carried her in the trunk of his car to the vacant lot where she was found. According to Gilmore, Smith also made a veiled reference to that other one who had been found in a bathtub, possibly Bauerdorf. Smith had actually come to the attention of L.A. County Sheriff's Detective Joel Lesnick in connection with that murder. Lesnick learned that Arnold Smith was one of many aliases for Jack Anderson Wilson, a tall, gaunt alcoholic with a bad leg and a history of robbery and sex offenses. After hearing Gilmore's tape and his first-hand account of meeting with Smith, Detective St. John knew he had to get to Smith directly. A parallel investigation found no proof that Al Morrison, the violent sexual sadist, existed, bolstering St. John's belief that Arnold Smith / Jack Anderson Wilson was really the killer. But in one of those eerie twists of fate, before a meeting between Gilmore and Smith, at which the police planned to pick him up for questioning, Smith, an alcoholic and heavy smoker, passed out in his bed at the Holland Hotel and set the room on fire. He was burned to death in the flames, which apparently also consumed any photos or personal effects of Short's he had shown Gilmore. In another book on the case, Daddy Was the Black Dahlia Killer, written with the respected crime writer Michael Newton, Janice Knowlton offers another theory. Knowlton claims that her late father, George Knowlton, was a child molester, serial killer of at least three, a baby killer, Satanist, and necrophiliac, and Beth Short's murderer. Her understanding of the connection to the Dahlia case, she claims, emerged when deeply repressed memories surfaced while recovering from a hysterectomy. According to Janice Knowlton, Short called George from the Biltmore. In Janice's memory, after beating Short to death with a hammer, George Knowlton used a power saw to cut Short in two, then forced his daughter to accompany him as he took the body to dump it in the ocean at Seal Beach. When it floated back, he washed and gutted it, took it to a cemetery, then changed his mind and dumped it in the vacant lot. In a Los Angeles Times story that ran 2 days after the murder, sources recalled Short saying she was engaged to an army pilot named George. At the end of January, someone named George visited a cafe on Santa Monica Boulevard several times, identified himself as an FBI agent but refused to show credentials, and asserted that he knew who killed Short. Note Malise from the description that this was her father. Newton concedes there is no proof of what she claims, but cites many coincidences in her father's life and the known facts of the Dahlia case. He also demonstrates striking similarities between the case and the unsolved murder of Francis Cochran in Lynn, Massachusetts in July 1941. In an Orange County Register article in June 1991, John St. John declared, "The facts as she presents them to me are not compatible with the murder of the Black Dahlia." It remains unsolved to this date. Other case devotees have claimed that the LAPD knew the identity of the Dahlia's killer, but covered it up to protect influential people. Some of these sources claim the same thing about the death of Marilyn Monroe. Theories, conspiracy, and otherwise abound. But this much we can state with certainty. Elizabeth Short was a victim of opportunity. Her killer was the type who would project blame on the victim. She brought it on herself, or she had to be punished for the kind of life she led. He'd had an emotional need to find someone he considered lower than himself, then degraded her to drive home the point. He would be a risk-taker who showed a mixed presentation in his criminal work. After the crime, I wouldn't have been surprised to see some major emotional disintegration. If it was severe enough, it could have precluded him from committing and getting away with additional crimes of this nature, but then we'd expect him to have been picked up or identified. Either way, with modern techniques, it should have been possible to recognize someone's post-offense behavior, whether that behavior involved another lust murder, a nervous breakdown, institutionalization, or suicide. This crime was driven by fantasy, which would continue after the murder. So I would surveil the dump site to see if the unsub came back to relive it. I think checking the grave site would also be a good idea. He would be interested in the case, possibly hanging out in bars or coffee shops frequented by the police. He may have confided details of the crime to someone, although this person too would be someone who lived on the fringes of society, as this unsub wouldn't have a lot of normal, successful friends. If he did confide in someone, it was likely at a moment of weakness, such as during a drinking binge, and he'd realize afterwards he'd made himself more vulnerable, putting his confidant in great personal danger. We will probably never know for sure who killed the Black Dahlia. Had Detective St. John had the opportunity to interrogate Arnold Smith, the outcome might have been different. But figuring out what kind of person killed her is not that difficult. As in so many of the cases we discussed, he told us through his crime. Laurentia Bimbenik. If Elizabeth Short represents a rather feeble and somewhat antiquated version of an American icon, Laurentia Bimbenik represents a stronger, more modern one. In its own way, however, her story is equally poignant and sad. Again, in Bimbenik's life, the myth and reality played side by side. She called herself Laurie, but the public decided she would be better known as Bambi, a gorgeous Midwestern blonde playboy bunny who became a capable and tough career girl, breaking into the traditionally all-boy realm of police work. She engendered the romantic notion of a beauty horribly wronged, convicted of a violent crime she swore she didn't commit, and once imprisoned, saved by a handsome prince who helped her escape and offered her true love. Then there was The Life on the Lam, encapsulated by any PR man's dream of a tagline, "Run, Bambi, run," in headlines, on T-shirts, and talk shows. Even this phrase demonstrates the inherent contradictions in the story, harkening back as it does to an archetypal Disney scene of Innocence Lost. The name was actually attached by male officers when she was a police recruit. The reality of all of this was considerably different, yet no less haunting. On May 28, 1981, shortly after 2:30 a.m., police officers responded to an emergency call at 1701 West Ramsey Street on the south side of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. They were let in by Sean Schultz, age 10, and his 8-year-old brother, Shannon. In the bedroom, officers found the boy's mother, Christine Jean Schultz, 30 years of age, evidently dead, lying on her right side in bed. She had dark brown hair and brown eyes, and was wearing a yellow Adidas T-shirt and white panties. The shirt was torn around a large bullet entry wound in her right shoulder. A clothesline cord bound her hands in front of her, and a blue bandana-type scarf was wrapped around her head, gagging her. There was no sign of a break-in, and the doors had heavy-duty deadbolt locks. The home was on a well-lit street, in a safe neighborhood, near other houses. It did, however, back up onto a freeway overpass. The back door was secluded and shielded from view. The freeway could have therefore provided an intruder with an escape route. It took 2 hours before the medical examiner was called, and an ambulance an hour later. When police wrapped the victim's body for transport, they removed a brown hair from her calf. Sean told police he had wakened to the feeling of something like a rope tightening around his throat. A large gloved hand covered his face. He struggled and screamed, then heard his assailant utter a deep growling sound and run across the hall. Sean followed his brother into the hallway and saw a man in his mother's room. Shannon described a large white male with a long ponytail, wearing a green jogging suit. He thought he held a pearl-handled gun. The younger boy heard a female voice from his mother's bedroom say, "God, please don't do that," then a sound like a firecracker. When the man ran out past them and scrambled down the stairs, both boys thought they noticed him wearing a green army jacket and low-cut black shoes, similar to the kind police officers wear. On this point, the boys could be expected to know what they were talking about, since their father, Christine's ex-husband Fred, and their mother's current boyfriend were both cops. Sean raced back to his mother, who was still alive, and ripped open her shirt to try to tend to her wound. At around 2:30 a.m., he called his mother's boyfriend, 41-year-old Stuart George Honick, for help. Sean would remember Honick saying, "I knew this would happen. I think Freddie did it." Honick called the police emergency number, then immediately went to Christine Schultz's house, accompanied by his roommate, Kenneth Rutkowski, another police officer. They arrived at virtually the same time as the patrol car Honick had summoned. Once inside, Honick went upstairs and rolled Christine's body over to check on her. Although this is a natural reaction on the part of a victim's boyfriend called in by her panicking children, technically, he disturbed the crime scene. This would be just one in a series of investigative irregularities. Alfred O. Fred Schultz, divorced from Christine the previous November after 11 years of marriage, was on duty that night when he was notified of the crime. He went to the crime scene while Christine was still in the house. Again, I can understand why he'd want to be there, especially with his sons in the house. But he should have been kept away. As the ex-husband, regardless of his alibi of being on duty, he would have to be considered a potential suspect. I know only too well, though, what must have transpired, because we've seen it in so many cases where a cop's family is involved. These other officers know him. No, these are his kids, this is his house, etc., and see him as a victim. It's a natural and common reaction. Schultz called and awakened his 21-year-old current wife, Laurencia Bembenek, to let her know what had happened. Then he and his partner, Detective Michael Durfee, drove to his and Lori's apartment 16 blocks from the crime scene. Fred felt the hood of her car, which he said was cold, and in Durfee's presence examined his off-duty .38. Durfee smelled it and examined it himself. There was dust on the weapon, and Durfee determined that it had not been fired that night nor recently cleaned. Fred asked Lori to accompany him to identify the victim, his ex-wife, and took the off-duty pistol with him in a briefcase. In what would prove to be another investigative miscue, Fred failed to have his off-duty revolver, which would later be determined to be the murder weapon, properly registered with the crime lab. The serial number of the weapon was not recorded, and the weapon remained in his possession for 3 weeks before he turned it in for examination. Later in the morning, around 4 a.m., two detectives came to the Schultz-Bembenek apartment and asked Lori if she owned a gun or a green jogging suit, then asked her some questions about her husband and Stuart Honick. In fact, the two men had once been roommates. Now, however, Fred was said to be unhappy about Honick dating his ex, and they strongly disliked each other. As for Lori, she said that at the time of the murder, she was home in the apartment alone and asleep. That evening, she'd been packing to move them into a smaller apartment. She had also planned to go out with a friend, but their date had been canceled. Police reconstructed the events of what proved to be the last night of Christine Schultz's life. That evening, she had made dinner for Honick, and they had several drinks together, finishing around 9 p.m., when the boys went to bed. The two adults watched television and then Christine drove Honig home, about 3 minutes away by car. Another account has him leaving on his own, with Christine requesting that he lock up behind him. 12 area residents, including 2 officers, had seen a man matching the boy's description jogging in the neighborhood a few weeks before the murder. He had reddish-brown hair tied in a ponytail, wore a green jogging suit, and carried a blue bandana similar to the one used to gag the victim. 2 nurses at a facility a mile from the scene had noticed a man lying in the parking lot around 2:50 a.m., the morning of the crime. They called police and, when they returned, observed a man with reddish-brown hair and a green jogging suit standing in the bushes. Ray Cuyava, a neighbor of the victim's, told police that on the night of the murder, when he was staying at a friend's house, someone had broken into his garage and stolen a .38 revolver and a green jogging suit. The postmortem examination by Dr. Elaine Samuels indicated that, when fired, the gun had been held against the victim's back, touching the skin. It entered her right shoulder and cut a direct path to her heart. A contact gunshot of this nature would produce a blowback effect, in which blood and tissue would have exploded back from the wound into the gun barrel. Christine's friends and relatives described her as a fine athlete, physically fit, and a lover of the outdoors. She also reportedly had a temper, and they felt it unlikely that she would have remained tied up in the kind of knot the killer used unless someone was holding a gun on her. Blood was found under her fingernails and on both walls near the head of the stairs. From here, things start to get complicated. Despite his partner's earlier assessment that Fred's service weapon hadn't been fired or cleaned recently, the regional crime lab's ballistics analysis indicated that the revolver, a Smith & Wesson .38 with a 4-inch barrel, showed traces of type A blood, both Fred's and Christine's blood type, and that the slug that killed Christine matched markings inside the gun barrel. In the house after the murder, Fred discovered a box of 200-grain Speer bullets, which he said belonged to him. Speer bullets had been standard issue for Milwaukee PD service revolvers, and Monty Lutz, a nationally recognized firearms expert, stated that enough markings linked the off-duty gun with the fatal bullet to make a definitive match. Other analysts also declared that the bullet that killed Christine Schultz could only have come from her ex-husband's weapon. Both Fred and Lori became suspects. Ex-husbands are always suspect, at least initially, and Fred Schultz could be seen to have a potential motive. Christine and the boys lived happily in the home that he himself had built, while he and Lori lived in a small apartment. On top of that, to help control costs, since he was paying alimony, child support, and the mortgage on the house, the newlyweds briefly shared an apartment with a friend, Judy Zess. According to Lori, Fred was extremely bitter over the amount of money the divorce settlement was costing him. He complained that his ex-wife was getting everything. And Christine reportedly told her attorney that she was afraid of Fred, saying he had threatened her life and wanted to maintain control over her and the children. She also felt she was being followed. Of course, bad feelings and harsh words are common in divorce cases, and nothing indicated Fred had acted on his. Lori was viewed as a more likely suspect because, while it was Fred's off-duty revolver that was used to kill Christine, he had an alibi, and Lori had been home alone that night, with access to the murder weapon. And she refused to take a polygraph when Fred's attorney advised her against it, though Fred agreed to one. He passed, but the test was damaging. He admitted to having punched Christine in the past, to lying about a speeding ticket, and to holding back the truth about where he'd been the night of the murder. In another departure from normal procedure, Fred Schultz's partner, Michael Durfee, could not produce his logbook from that night. It was later learned that although they said they had been investigating a burglary, 2 uniformed officers had actually conducted that investigation. Schultz and Durfee had been in a couple of bars the night of the shooting, while on duty. Schultz still had a solid alibi, but the revelation was embarrassing at the very least. Circumstantial evidence piled up as people came forward to build the image of Lori Bimbenik as a conniving, greedy second wife. Judy Zess's mother, Frances, claimed she had heard Lori talking at a dinner party a few months before the murder about having Christine blown away. Judy confirmed this, and both said it was because of how much money Fred had to give his ex-wife. Judy also claimed Lori had approached Judy's boyfriend, Thomas Gertner, about finding someone who could have Fred's ex-wife rubbed out. And, according to Judy, Laurie had owned both a blue bandana and a clothesline similar to those found at the crime scene. A number of people tied Laurie to a green jogging suit, including Judy Zess, who said there'd been one in the apartment she once shared with Laurie and Fred, though none was ever found. But, as we've seen in other cases, accounts and leads went off in a variety of directions. Hairs found on the body and in the bandana were consistent with those of the victim, according to Dr. Elaine Samuels. But then Diane Hansen, a hair analyst from a Madison, Wisconsin crime lab, stated that two of the hairs were consistent with samples taken from Lori Bimbenick's hairbrush, seized by police. This evidence is open to question, however, and could have been planted. In a 1983 letter quoted in the Toronto Star in 1991, Dr. Samuels reaffirmed, "I recovered no blonde or red hairs of any length or texture. All of the hairs I recovered from the body were brown and were grossly identical to the hair of the victim." Samuels continued, "I do not like to suggest that evidence was altered in any way, but I can find no logical explanation for what amounted to the mysterious appearance of blonde hair in an envelope that contained no such hair at the time it was sealed by me." Then she concluded, "These departures from standard procedure, coupled with the hostile attitude of police during the investigation, lead me to the conclusion that something may be amiss." A reddish-brown wig was found clogging the plumbing of the apartment where Laurie and Fred lived. Not only did the color match the description of the intruder's hair provided by the Schultz boys, the wig hair was also consistent with hairs found on the victim's body. But even this piece of evidence raises more questions than it answers. Their apartment shared drainage with another apartment, and a woman who lived in that apartment said that Judy Zess had visited her and asked to use the restroom. The next person to use the bathroom found it clogged, occasioning the retrieval of the wig. Zess later admitted owning a brownish shoulder-length wig. And Laurie said that Judy's boyfriend, Thomas Gertner, blamed Fred for the death of his best friend, an off-duty cop shot by Fred, and claimed he would get even. Despite all of this, the bulk of the largely circumstantial evidence pointed to Laurencia Bimbenick. On June 26, 1981, she was charged with the first-degree murder of Christine Schultz, primarily because she had access to the murder weapon and lacked a confirmable alibi for the night in question. So, while she, Fred, Judy Zess, Thomas Gertner, and the landlord all had keys to the apartment, Laurie was there alone around the time the murder occurred. It was believed that, as a former police officer, she'd know how to cover her tracks, and that, since she was tall and strong, in disguise, she could easily appear to be a man to Christine's two boys, despite the fact that Sean insisted he had seen a man and even testified that it couldn't have been Laurie. Bimbenick went to trial on February 24, 1982. Much was made in both the courtroom and the media of the defendant's beauty and feminist leanings, which led some to suggest Bambi was on trial as much for her image as for the murder of Christine Schultz. Circuit Judge Michael Skwarowski noted, "It was the most circumstantial case I've ever seen, with lots of individual pieces that would not have convicted her. But taken as a whole, the jury could reach only one conclusion." An example of the kind of ambiguity Judge Skwarowski might have been thinking of concerned the murder weapon itself. In a July 31, 1990 article reviewing the Bimbenick case, reporter Rogers Worthington wrote in the Chicago Tribune, "Ballistics tests showed the gun collected from Schultz and tested on June 21st was indeed the murder weapon. But at the trial, neither Schultz nor Durfee could say with certainty that the gun shown to them in the courtroom was the same one they had looked at the night of the murder." The jury of five men and seven women took 3.5 days to find Bimbenick guilty and deliver their verdict on March 9th. She was sentenced to life in prison. From Tachita Correctional Institution, Bimbenick continued to protest her innocence, claiming she was framed by the Milwaukee Police Department to stop her from releasing evidence she had of drug use, debauchery, and improper use of government funds by members of the department. This was an important touchstone in the development of Bambi lore. To understand why so many people following the case at the time felt that she had been railroaded, we have to know something of her background. Laurencia Ann Bimbenick was the youngest of three daughters born to Joseph and Virginia Bimbenick in Milwaukee. Joseph had been a Milwaukee police officer, but left after 3 years because of what he saw as widespread corruption on the force. He then became a carpenter. Lori, as she was called, grew up wanting to become a veterinarian but lacked the academic background. She took a 2-year college course in fashion merchandising and earned money from a variety of brief jobs such as modeling and aerobics instruction, not surprising since she was tall, beautiful, and athletic. She once posed in a slinky dress as Miss March 1978 for a Schlitz Brewing Company calendar, which is where some of the mythology comes from. But she also had strong feminist views and entered the Milwaukee Police Academy in March 1980. Right from the beginning, she felt harassed for being a woman in a man's world. As Chris Radish recounts in her book, Run, Bambi, Run, Lori attended a concert in Milwaukee with then-fellow recruit Judy Zess and 3 other friends. While Lori was using the ladies' room, Judy was arrested by 2 plainclothes officers for marijuana possession. The following day, Bimbenek Sergeant and another officer called her in and grilled her about every aspect of her life. Judy was fired when a small marijuana joint was found in a cup under her chair, and Lori was once again hammered by her superiors, who tried to get her to confess to smoking pot, too. Lori refused to confess to something she didn't do. It seemed to her that she was taking abuse for being a woman, but on July 25, 1980, she graduated 6th in her class from the Milwaukee Police Academy and got her badge. She was assigned to the 2nd District, not a heavy crime area, and was almost instantly appalled by what she said she saw on the street and within the department. Graft, corruption, drinking on duty, drug abuse, oral sex with prostitutes, mistreatment of suspects. Still, she took personal pride in being a cop and enjoyed the time out on patrol or working on her own. On August 25th, just a month after her graduation from the academy, Lori got a call at home from a captain telling her she was being dismissed. She had no idea why. 2 sergeants came by and took her badge, gun, and her uniforms. Chief Harold A. Breyer axed 3 female officers that week, the other 2 black, all in their probationary period. The only explanation was that it was for the good of the service. According to the Milwaukee Journal a few days after this, Lori was charged with untruthfulness and making a false official report, but no details were given. Weeks later, when she finally got to look at her personnel file, Bimbenek found that Judy Zess had signed a statement saying that Lori had also used marijuana at the concert. Judy admitted signing it, but told Lori it was done under duress after hours of interrogation. Both women were appealing their dismissals, and Lori forgave Judy, agreeing that they should move in together. Waiting out her appeal, desperate for money, Lori got a job as a waitress at the Lake Geneva Playboy Club. She only kept the job a few weeks, but the bunny connection solidified the image she was to take on, the confusing combination of tough cop, ardent feminist, and beautiful sex object. As with Elizabeth Short, the public saw one thing, and the individual herself lived quite another. U.S. Attorney James Morrison began investigating allegations that the Milwaukee PD was misusing hundreds of thousands of dollars of affirmative action funds and firing minorities on flimsy grounds. Lori came forward to claim that women were being hired and quickly fired just to satisfy federal quotas and take advantage of grants. She filed a lawsuit against the department, charging discrimination. In October of 1980, she obtained photographs of nude male officers dancing in a public park. After she handed them over to the Internal Affairs Division, her car's tires were slashed, she found a dead rat deposited on her windshield, and she received repeated anonymous late-night calls. Perhaps significantly, when she was charged with murder, the federal investigation against the police, of which she was a key component, fell apart. Bimbenek met Fred Schultz in December of 1980, a month after he and Christine had divorced. Within a few weeks of their meeting, Fred proposed to Lori, and they were married on January 30, 1981. It's not difficult to see why some thought Lori Bimbenek may not have been treated as a normal murder suspect. I've said before that an individual doesn't just wake up one day and decide to become a murderer. In Bimbenek's case, what we see is a history of going out on a limb to do the right thing. She seemed to believe cops should be held to a higher standard of behavior, and she suffered because of her actions. Does this mean it would be impossible for her to commit an illegal or violent act? No. But I think it makes it a hell of a lot less likely she's going to blow away the mother of two young children in cold blood. To be fair in our assessment, though, let's begin with what we can learn from the crime itself, starting with victimology. What I've always said is that you start by looking at what was going on in and around the victim's life in the days and weeks leading up to the crime. Christine Schultz was in her own home, in a safe neighborhood, which would seem to place her at low risk to be the victim of such a violent crime. But she had worried she was being followed. If her ex-husband was as controlling as she said, and if, as has been reported, her current boyfriend had a drinking problem, a history of difficult relationships would raise her risk level. The crime, as it unfolded, makes no sense. By this I mean that the chain of events is not logical. Why would an unsub start in the mother's room, then go for the children, then return to the mother to finish her off? It would be one thing if the boys were awakened by the shot, and so the offender had to contend with them. But that's not what happened here. Let's say the offender surprised Christine in her bed and controlled her by threatening to kill her kids if she awakened them. He tied her up. Why would he then leave her alone, alive, and go into the boys' room? There's no motive or logic to that. Keeping those kids alive and asleep would be the best means the subject had for making Christine cooperate. It's much better control than any binding or weapon. When the subject left Christine's room, this woman, described as athletic, would be like a mother bear with instincts to protect her cubs. At the very least, she'd scream out a warning to wake them before the intruder had a chance to start strangling one of them. This makes me wonder whether there wasn't a second subject, someone to keep an eye on the mother while the other went into the boys' room. There has been speculation that the events were staged to unfold that way, to make sure the children were awake and close enough to the intruder-slash-murderer so they could get a good look at him and be able to state later who it was not. We can't be sure of this, of course, but it is a possible explanation for the otherwise bizarre chain of events leading up to the victim's murder. The bandana ligature would seem to serve no real purpose in the crime, and so might be considered an element of staging to try to throw off investigators. This leads us to the greater question of motive for the crime. First, it seems unlikely this was a robbery, since the timing was high risk, and everything indicates the intruder sought out the victim. If Christine Schultz had heard a noise, she would have been found someplace else in the house, where she'd gone to investigate, not still in her bed. There might even have been a call to the police, and we can rule out sexual assault as a motive, since there was no sign of it, and the unsub actually left his victim to go to the boys' room. It's not a criminal enterprise homicide, and it's not sexual homicide. So why did Christine Schultz die? And what kind of person would have killed her? First off, it's pretty ballsy to enter a home when three people are there, which says to me that we're dealing with someone who's comfortable with breaking and entering, someone experienced. There was no sign of forced entry, so this unsub either had a key or knew how to get in unnoticed. And if he had a key and or was that comfortable with the home, he likely knew the victim was the ex-wife of one police officer and girlfriend of another. He would have to consider that she herself might have a gun. Was he nuts? Between the risk level of the crime to the offender and the way it was perpetrated, not the type of personal cause homicide we see from female offenders, even strong feminist ones, I am comfortable saying that Lori Bimbenek does not fit this profile. I also had trouble with the case against Bimbenek because I just don't see the motive as it was presented. Do I think she would have been happier with more money? Certainly. Who wouldn't? But if she were cold-blooded enough to kill for money, she would have taken out the kids, too. She didn't want to be the instant mother of two, no matter how much they may have gotten along during visits. She was a newlywed. And while it was a decent house, after the murder she and Fred fought over how she did not want to move there. We might expect her to protest a bit to throw off suspicion, but not to the point of risking damage to her relationship with her husband. For me to see greed as a motive, it would have to have been affecting her relationship with Fred. There would have been reports from witnesses about how their previously great relationship had gone to seed because he was so upset over the loss of the house or that their money troubles were ruining everything. But we didn't see this. To the contrary, instead of this being one of the world's great romances gone bad, Ben Bennick's relationship with Fred Schultz was really more of a rebound. He'd been married to Christine more than a decade and was only divorced a few months when he married Lori, and they'd only known each other briefly when they married. No matter how sincere their affections, it was still a new, somewhat superficial relationship. If we argue that she hadn't intended to kill her husband's ex-wife, but merely scare her out of the house and then was forced to kill when Christine recognized her, this makes even less sense. First, it doesn't jibe with the chronology of the crime as outlined earlier. It's also terribly high risk, especially for a trained law officer, to assume that none of the three victims would recognize her. And then we might have expected to see some staging, such as a TV set taken or the victim's clothing pulled off, to make it look like something other than personal cause homicide. Certainly we wouldn't expect Ben Bennick, again a trained police officer, to discard evidence, such as the wig, in such a way as to lead investigators right back to her doorstep and to forget or to neglect to have an alibi.
So if Lori Ben Bennick didn't kill Christine Schultz,
who did? It's hard to answer that when the investigation could have gone off in so many different directions with the conflicting leads generated. It is safe to say, though, that with this type of personal cause homicide, the individual responsible would have been an obvious suspect and would have known this, so he or she would have gone out of the way to establish an alibi.
Lori Ben Bennick's story didn't end with her trial, conviction, and incarceration.
In 1983, the conviction was upheld by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. 4 months later, she and Fred filed for divorce, which was granted in June of 1984. During the trial, Fred had been supportive and later established a defense fund for her. But after the Court of Appeals decision, he said he had become convinced that she was guilty.
Ben Bennick fought unsuccessfully to get a new trial for several years.
In the meantime, she continued to inspire passion. Several men reportedly became infatuated with her, or should we say, her image. One apparently even paid an imprisoned hitman to confess to the Schultz murder to get Lori off the hook. But when prosecutors refused to grant the convict immunity, he refused to testify. There was one positive aspect to her notoriety. As long as there was interest in her, new people were willing to work on her case. One such individual was Milwaukee private investigator Ira Robbins, who spent years reinvestigating the Schultz murder.
Before Robbins and Ben Bennick's relationship soured over financial issues, Robbins uncovered potentially exculpatory evidence attorneys would use in future bids to get Ben Bennick a new trial.
Then, on July 15, 1990, her story entered its next phase when she climbed out a small window in the prison laundry and escaped, fleeing with her handsome boyfriend Dominic Gugliotto, brother of another inmate. While she may have been seeking a normal life, with this move, she sealed her notorious celebrity status. 72% of callers to a popular Wisconsin radio program said if they knew where she was, they wouldn't report it or turn her in. Coverage of her case and the slogan, "Run, Bambi, run," grew well beyond the borders of the state. The couple was arrested just 3 months later in Thunder Bay, Canada, following a segment on America's Most Wanted, which led to a tip that she was waiting tables at a local restaurant.
In an interesting move, Ben Bennick applied for refugee status under Geneva Convention rules, citing her inability to get a new trial in the face of mounting evidence of her innocence. After a number of legal maneuvers back and forth between Ben Bennick forces and U.S. and Canadian authorities, including an American judicial investigation into Ben Bennick's case, she was returned to Milwaukee. Ben Bennick's attorneys prepared a motion for a new trial that included affidavits from witnesses who said a career criminal, Frederick Hornberger, told them that Fred Schultz had paid him $10,000 to kill Christine.
Hornberger later recanted just before killing himself during a botched robbery and hostage situation in 1991. The attorneys also secured affidavits from two forensic pathologists that the handgun used to convict Ben Bennick was not consistent with the muzzle imprints on the victim's body, eliminating it as the murder weapon. The following month, a government lawyer produced a letter from a leading authority on gunshot wounds contradicting the affidavits of the pathologists. But at the very least, this exchange demonstrated that the issue was open to serious dispute.
Facing Horenberger's original story, the switched gun theory, and other evidence developed by the defense, plus the loss of witnesses on their side over time, the DA's office was ready to deal. Lori was afraid a new trial would come too late. She wanted to spend more time with her aging parents, so she agreed. In a December 1992 arrangement, her prior conviction was set aside, and she pleaded no contest to the lesser charge of second-degree murder in return for being released on parole based on time already served. In recent years, she has faced bankruptcy, lawsuits, and serious health problems, including hepatitis C. We tried to interview her for this book, but she declined our request, which I have to say I can understand. Whether viewed as guilty or innocent, this woman has lived her entire adult life under the specter of this case and the image of her it created in the public eye. We'll close with words from an interview she did give years ago, when she summed up, "I'm tired of being Lori Bimbenek." The Boston Strangler. With the Boston Strangler murders, we get a different angle on myth versus reality and the quest for recognition and fulfillment. A man who gained lasting fame by holding himself out as the great American anti-hero and Superman of serial crime, confessing to the brutal and sadistic killing of 11 women. On the evening of June 14, 1962, Anna Slessers, a 55-year-old seamstress, had just finished dinner in her small third-floor apartment in a converted townhouse at 77 Gainsborough Street in Boston's Back Bay. She had moved in only 2 weeks earlier. Most of her neighbors were students and retired people on limited budgets. She drew the water for a quick bath before her 25-year-old son, Juris, was to pick her up for the Latvian memorial service being held at their church. Just before